chronological record. 3. Apparently, it was during the Abejas phase, circa 3400 to 2300 BC, that maize came under cultivation, and from that period on, dependable signs increase of the practice of some sort of horticulture, supplementary to the timeless primitive arts of foraging, hunting, and fishing, the people, be it noted, dwelling still in caves. B. Concurrently in Tamaulipas. 1. In the Infiernillo phase, circa 7000 to 5000 BC, evidences again are registered of certain wild plants later domesticated. Agave, opuntia, runner beans, chili peppers, a gourd, and a pumpkin. 2. The Ocampo phase, circa 5000 to 3000 BC, shows pumpkins of a larger seed and both yellow and red large beans, any or all of which may have been domesticated. 3. During the so-called La Pera phase, circa 3000 to 2200 BC, domesticated maize appears, derived apparently from the Tehuacan development. C. There is a possibility also that domesticated maize may have reached South America at about this time, and that in Peru as early as circa 3800 to 3000 BC, lima beans and bottle gourds may have begun to be cultivated. In any case, it is from these last dates onward, 3800 to 2200 BC, that signs of a primitive type of garden cultivation, practiced by cave-dwelling hunting and fishing folk, first appear in the Americas, increasing until, by circa 1500 BC, the beginnings of something resembling a genuine Neolithic stage of village farming can be said to have been attained. But the critical period thus indicated corresponds exactly to that of the first securely documented trans-Pacific landings of visitors from Asia. And these, furthermore, may not have been the first trans-Pacific voyagers either. In The Masks of God, I reviewed the evidences for a trans-Pacific contribution to the so-called formative period of the New World civilizations as the case stood in 1959, when the earliest verified date for plant domesticates in the New World was circa 1016 BC, plus or minus 300 years, and the materials in hand found on the northern coast of Peru at a site called Huaca Prieta consisted of twined net and woven fabrics of what appeared to be an Asiatic cotton, together with two small bottle gourds bearing highly stylized carved figures suggesting trans-Pacific themes. A double bird head and the mask of a sort of cat or jaguar man, the bottle gourd being a plant not known to be native to America. In addition, there had been unearthed in association with these remains a few bits of bark cloth, that is, tapa, which is an oceanic culture trait. Today, however, as remarked above, there is more to tell. For in December 1960, a fragment of Japanese cord-marked Jomon pottery of a date circa 3000 BC was unearthed on the coast of Ecuador, and subsequent digs along that coast soon yielded many fragments more, these being the earliest evidences of ceramicware yet found anywhere in the New World. Moreover, a number of ceramic female figurines were included in the finds, and these are the earliest figurines known for the Americas. Significantly, a pilot chart of the North Pacific Ocean published by the Hydrographic Office of the Navy, USA, shows the course of one of the strongest west-to-east ocean currents running northward from the neighborhood of the Japanese island of Kyushu, bending eastward in a great arc over Hawaii and then down exactly to the Guayas coast of Ecuador. Japanese pottery of the early to middle Jomon period has now been dated by the carbon-14 method, circa 3140 BC, plus or minus 400 years, and that of this so-called Valdivia phase of the Ecuadorian coast, circa 3190 BC, plus or minus 150 years. Words, state the finders, do not adequately express the degree of similarity between early Valdivia and contemporary Jomon pottery. In most categories of decorative technique, examples can be found so similar in appearance that they might almost have come from the same vessel. And in a series of handsomely photographed plates of numerous matching samples, they have demonstrated their point so well that the viewer, to keep the two orders apart, must draw a line between. Already in the first years of the present century, it was evident to Frobenius that, in his words, a bridge existed and not a chasm between America and Asia. Subsequently, Dr. Adolf Jensen, director of the Forschungsinstitut für Kulturmorphologie, Frankfurt am Main, demonstrated in his studies of the myths and rites of tropical planting cultures that, even on the primitive Mesolithic level, there is a cultural continuum extending from Africa eastward through India, Southeast Asia, and Oceania to America, and that one of the characteristic features of this equatorial Kulturkreis is the myth of a killed and cut-up ancestral being from whose buried remains food plants grow. In every province of the early planting cultures of the world, this archetypal origin myth has been adapted to the local vegetation. In primitive Indonesia, it is referred to as the banana, coconut, and yam. In Polynesia, to the same. In Japan, to rice. In Mexico, to maize. And in Brazil, to manioc. In ancient Egypt, the plant was wheat. Can the Sioux have been touched by this widely known equatorial tradition? It would be amazing had they not. Longfellow, in The Song of Hiawatha, Part 5, Hiawatha's Fasting, has rendered into verse an instance of the planting myth in question, drawn from Henry Schoolcroft's algic researches. Its source was an Ojibwa legend of the origin of maize from a slain, cut-up, and buried divinity, the Ojibwa being an Algonquin tribe inhabiting the same general region at the headwaters of the Mississippi that the Sioux had known in the 16th century. Moreover, at the time of the earlier residents of the Sioux further south, in the middle Mississippi, there had been a mighty concentration there of truly agricultural towns of many thousand souls, raising crops of maize, squash, and beans with immense rectangular temple mounds arranged around central plazas, spiritual as well as secular governors, and recondite iconographies. This culture had struck its roots, as we have said, as early as the 5th century B.C., It culminated in the 15th AD with extensions eastward to the Atlantic and westward into both Arkansas and eastern Oklahoma, as well as north through Illinois. The culture level was about equivalent to that of France in the period of Caesar's Gallic Wars, the period of Vercingetorix. And the temple mounds, as well as a number of other features, let us know that influences from Mexico had been of considerable force. In sum, then, the possibility or even probability of extremely early trans-Pacific contacts of a more than passing influence on equatorial America, the evidence of Japanese ceramic wares of a date circa 3000 BC found on the coast of Ecuador, and the evidence somewhat southward on the shoreline of Peru from circa 1016 BC of tapa, an Asiatic cotton, and bottle gourds carved with mythic figures of a style suggesting Shang China, Shang is now dated circa 1572 to 1027 BC, suggest very strongly that Frobenius can have been right. And such early primitive contacts are not the only ones of which we have signs, for there is notable evidence also of a sequence of later contributions from China and Southeast Asia, affecting the nuclear centers of Middle and South America. These commence at least as early as the 8th century BC, when China was already halfway through its great period of the Chao dynasty, early Chao circa 1027 to 771 BC, middle Chao 722 to 480 BC, late Chao 480 to 221 BC, and continue to the 12th century AD when the marvelous Khmer civilization of Angkor circa AD 600 to circa 1300 seems to have influenced the Mayan architecture and sculpture of Chiapas, Tabasco, Campeche, and the Peyton, as well as the Toltec arts of the fabled feathered serpent king, Quetzalcoatl. It is entirely possible, therefore, that all those elements that have impressed us as familiar in the mythology of the Sioux are actually constituents of the same great mythological complex of the agriculturally based high civilizations from which our own mythological heritage derives, and that, consequently, they do not represent either an accident of cultural convergence or any generally valid archetypology of the human psyche, but an archetypology only of the higher agriculturally based civilizations, which, as we know from the archaeology of the nuclear Near East, had its beginnings in the proto- and early Neolithic towns and villages of that area, circa 9000 BC, and came to its first full flowering in the early cities of Mesopotamian Sumer, circa 3500 to 2500 BC. The Paleolithic background. The enveloping atmosphere of Old Black Elk's legend, however, is very different from that of the myths of planting cultures, whether of the Old World or of the New. It is definitely of a hunting race and resembles in spirit and tone the Blackfoot legend of the origin of the buffalo dance that I have retold in Primitive Mythology from George Bird Grinnell's Blackfoot Lodge Tales. The main point of all such legends is that between the animals hunted and the human communities dependent for survival on their offering of themselves, there has been a covenant established, confirmed, and reconfirmed in certain rites performed in relation to certain fetishes, both the rites and the sacred tokens having been delivered years ago by the animals themselves to ensure that when they had been slain, their lives should be returned to the mother source for rebirth. And reciprocally, when such rites were performed and the mystery of the order of nature thus recognized, the food supply of the human community would be assured. Among the hunting tribes of the Buffalo Plains, the legends of this type are innumerable, and they are in many features very different from the corresponding myths of tropical planting folk. The rites, of which they tell the origins, are not, for the most part, referred to a remote age of mythological ancestors, but are supposed to have been derived from historical encounters of actual human beings with the animal mothers or master animals of vision, as we have just seen, for instance, in Black Elk's Sioux legend of the Sacred Pipe. So that even in such a legend as that of the Ojibwa origin of maize, where a typical planting myth from the tropical zone has been taken over by a hunting folk together with the plant itself, the divine being cut up and buried is represented not as a divinity of the mythological age, but as a vision appearing to a gifted youth at the time of his puberty fast, hence Longfellow's title for his version of the episode, Hiawatha's Fasting. Now, the Sioux and the Blackfeet were enemies and of very different racial stocks. The Blackfeet were Algonquins from the forested north, snowshoe and toboggan folk, whereas the Sioux, as we have seen, were from the south. Yet in their legends of the Buffalo Plains, to which both, like all their neighbors, were relative newcomers, they were, so to say, of the same mythological stock. Whence, then, could this shared mythological stock have been derived, which, moreover, was shared with modifications by all the other racially various contending peoples of the plains, Paiutes, Kiowas, Pawnees, Comanches, and the rest, none of whom had known anything of the buffalo before migrating to the plains. There is now considerable evidence that in the symbolic lore of the North American buffalo plains, there survived to the end of the 19th century and even into the 20th, a powerful late formation of truly Paleolithic culture forms. There is a variety of North American stone spearhead called the Clovis Point, for which a radiocarbon date has been established circa 35,000 BC plus. A number of examples have been found associated with the mammoth. There have been reports of an excavation 15 miles northeast of Barstow in the Mojave Desert, California, where nearly 200 chalcedony chips and blades have been brought to light from a depth assigned by radiocarbon tests to circa 40,000 BC. The first discovered example of another very early stone spearhead, the Folsom Point, was found amidst the bones of an extinct species of bison, its date not later than 8,000 BC. But these are dates of the range approximately of the great Paleolithic grottos of southern France and northern Spain, Altamira, Lascaux, etc., which have now been assigned to a period of some 20,000 years, from circa 30,000 to circa 10,000 BC. It is really an amazing, thrilling experience for anyone familiar with the legends of our North American Indians to enter any one of those French or Spanish caves. One is immediately transported to the same visionary field, where the mystery dimension of man's residence in the universe opens through an iconography of animal messengers. The great caves were not domestic sites, but sanctuaries of the men's rites, rituals of the hunt, of generations living by the hunt, and of initiation to the mythological substratum of their rigorous lives. The caves are dangerous and absolutely dark, and the pictures on the rocky walls are never at the entrances, but begin where the light of day is lost and unfold then deep within. The painted animals living there forever in that darkness beyond the tick of time are the germinal, deathless herds of the cosmic night, from which zone those on Earth, which appear and disappear in continuous renewal, proceed and back to which they return. And where human forms appear among them, they are generally male, costumed as shamans, wearing such animal-like masquerade as American Indian shamans wear to this day. One sees also on these cavern walls many silhouetted handprints, hands of the hunters of those times, and from a number of them certain finger joints are missing. Our Plains Indians, too, chopped off their finger joints, as offerings to the sun or to Wakantanka, with prayers for power and success. In several of the caves, deep and special chambers have been found, where rites of exceptional power must have been celebrated. In the Grotto of Trois Frères in the Pyrenees, for example, there is a long tube-like passage, a flume, hardly 2 feet in mean diameter, through which one has to crawl and wriggle on one's belly for a distance of some 50 yards, to come to a large chamber with animal forms engraved everywhere on the walls, and among them, directly opposite and facing the mouth of the very difficult passage, is the celebrated dancing sorcerer of Trois Frères, with the antlers of a stag, a beard flowing to his chest, the body and front paws of a lion, tail of a horse, and legs of a man. At Lascaux, in a kind of crypt or lower chamber, there is what appears to be a shaman lying in a shamanistic trance, wearing the mask and costume of a bird. His shaman staff is beside him, bearing on its top the figure of a bird. And standing before him is a great bison bull, struck from behind mortally by a lance. Mysteriously, a rhinoceros strolls by. Then again in the Pyrenees, in the cave Tuc d'Adobert, which is neighbor to Trois Frères, there is a little chamber entered only by a very small hole, through which a man can scarcely squeeze. Within are two clay figures in high relief, unique in Paleolithic art, representing a bison bull and cow, the bull following the cow, while on the ground round about are what appear to be the footprints of a boy dancing on his heels, possibly in imitation of the hoofprints of the buffalo. Moreover, there were also in this chamber a number of phallic forms, roughly modeled in clay. With these caves, and in particular with this last sanctuary in mind, I believe we can now presume to say that we have followed our goddess Buffalo to the sanctum sanctorum of her source, and now know from what far land and time beyond their ken the very beautiful woman came whom the two Sioux Indians saw on the North American plain. For there can be no question concerning the land of origin of the hunting tribes of North America. The vast area of the Paleolithic Great Hunt, which stretched in a single sweep from the Pyrenees to Lake Baikal in Siberia, actually went on to the Mississippi. And the peoples who first came to America from northern Asia and continued to come in many waves brought with them the rites and hunting methods of that world. These rites and methods, that is to say, were not separately invented in Europe, Asia, and America, but were carried from one area to the other. And the mythogenetic zone, the primary region of origin of the myths, was certainly the old world, not the new. North America was, therefore, not a primary zone, but a zone of diffusion to which the myths and rites were transported. However, in the course of a transfer of this kind, myths do not rest inert. There are two transforming processes of secondary creativity that come into play inevitably when a mythology is transferred from one landscape to another. The first I would term, following Ananda K. Kumaraswamy, land-taking. In the case, for example, of the ubiquitous planting myth above mentioned, the mythological being who was sacrificed, buried, and now lives in the food plants is variously associated in Brazil with manioc, in Japan with rice, and in Mexico with maize. It is everywhere the same myth, the same mystery play, but in each province the local landscape has become its theater, and local animals and plants are its actors. Land-taking, then, is the act of taking spiritual possession of a newly entered land with all its elements by assimilation to a myth already carried in the immigrant's heart as the spiritual support of a continuing culture. We are not to suppose that in every province of the tropical continuum the one same myth was separately developed. The second transforming process to be noted is one that has been closely studied lately in many ethnological works, namely acculturation. Here, motifs from an alien culture complex are taken into a native tradition by a process of syncretistic assimilation, and the rapidity with which such a process can yield results is amazing. In the case of the recent cargo cults of Melanesia, for example, which arose throughout that area immediately following the Second World War, when the natives, who had enjoyed for a time the magical bounty of goods supernaturally derived from American military cargoes, thought to bring back those fabulous days by enacting millenarian rites of expectation. Like a flash fire, the new rituals penetrated far beyond the colonial culture zone, deep into the bush, the wild country of peoples who had never seen a white man. New ideas travel fast, and so it was of old also in America, when the mythologies of Mexico penetrated the Mississippi. The motifs of the higher mythology were syncretistically assimilated by the northern hunters and applied to their own concerns. Both the Sioux and the Pawnee, for example, assimilated to the image of the master buffalo of the Paleolithic hunting era, the Mexican astronomical myth of the four world ages, the same four that were known to Hesiod as the ages of gold, silver, bronze, and iron, and to India as the cycle of four yugas, during the course of which the cow of virtue lost with each passing yuga one leg, standing first on four, then on three, then two, and now in our miserable last acre of the cycle on one. Both the Pawnee and the Sioux declare that their cosmic buffalo, the father and grandfather of the universe, stands at the cosmic gate through which the game animals pour into this temporal world and back through which they go when they are slain to be reborn. And in the course of the cycle of the four world ages, with the passage of each year, that master buffalo sheds one hair, and with the passage of each of the world ages, one leg. The resemblance of this striking image to that of India is amazing, and the more so when it is compared not only with the cow losing its legs, but also with a tale from the Brahmavivarta Purana that Heinrich Zimmer recounts at the opening of his volume Myths and Symbols in Indian Art and Civilization. There, the Lord of the Universe, the god Shiva, whose animal is the white bull Nandi, appears in the form of an old yogi named Hari, who has on his chest a circular patch of hair, from which one hair falls at the end of each cosmic cycle. At the end of a Brahma year of such cosmic cycles, all the hairs are gone and the universe dissolves into the night sea, the ocean of milk, to be renewed. Who will say by what miracle, whether of history or of psychology, these two homologous images came into being, the one in India and the other in North America? It is, of course, possible that either one of the two paths of diffusion just described may have been followed. However, it is also possible that the two images were independently developed by some process of convergence, as an effect, to use Fraser's word again, of similar causes acting alike on the similar constitution of the human mind in different countries and under different skies. For in India, too, there was a meeting and joining of animal and plant cultures when the Aryans with their herds arrived in the Dravidian agricultural zone. Analogous processes may have been set in play, as in two separate alchemical retorts. So that we must now confess that our tracking down of the goddess buffalo may have brought us to a problem not of history only, but of psychology as well. We have perhaps broken beyond the walls of time and space and should ask by what psychological as well as historical laws these primitive myths and their counterparts in the higher cultures might have been formed. The psychological base. There is no such thing, however, as an uncommitted psychology of man qua man, abstracted from a specific historical field. For, as I have already pointed out in Bios and Mythos, the human infant is born, biologically speaking, a year too soon, completing in the social sphere a development that other species accomplish within the womb. In fact, developing in the social sphere precisely those powers most typically human, upright posture, rational thought, and speech. Man as man develops in a manner that is simultaneously biological and social, and this development continues through adolescence, indeed through life. Moreover, whereas the instinct system of the animal is relatively inflexible, fixed, stereotyped according to species, that of man is not so, but open to imprint and impression. The innate releasing mechanisms of the human central nervous system, through which man's instincts are triggered to action, respond to sign stimuli that are not fixed for all time and general to the species, but vary from culture to culture, even from century to century and individual to individual, according to imprints indelibly registered during the long course of a sociologically conditioned childhood. And, if I have read aright the works of the specialists in this field of psychological research, there has not yet been identified a single triggering image, a single sign stimulus that can be firmly verified as innate to the human psyche. How, then, shall we rest secure in any theory of psychological archetypes based upon our own culturally conditioned mode of responses, or upon a study of the myths and symbols of our own tradition, or even upon a comparative study of that large complex of primitive planting and higher agricultural traditions, which, as I have just indicated, are both historically and prehistorically related to our own? We have to accept the fact that the walls have lately been knocked from around all mythologies, every single one of them, by the findings and works of modern scientific discovery. The four ages, the four points of the compass, the four elements, what can those mean to anyone today in the light of what we are learning? Today, we have 103 elements, and the number is still growing. The old soul and the new universe, the old microcosm and the new macrocosm, do not match, and the disproportion is about equivalent to that of 4 to 103. No wonder, then, if a lot of us are nervous. The little Tower of Babel, which to some in its day seemed to be threatening God in his heaven, we see now surpassed many times in every major city of the world, and rockets fly where once the angels sang. One cannot tutoyer God anymore. The mystery is infinite, both without and within. That is the tremendum that our modern mind, this flower of creation, has revealed for us to absorb, and it cannot be willed or walled away by any system of archaic feeling. It will not be screened from us, nor will we be protected by any organization of archaic images. There has not yet been identified a single image, the point cannot be too often repeated, that can be definitely guaranteed as innate to man. And so, it would seem, we are compelled to face the problem of the imagery of myth largely from a historical point of view after all. There is a remarkable passage in a letter of Charles Darwin, addressed to a certain W. Graham who had inquired concerning his religious beliefs, where it is suggested that even the image of God may be only an imprint impressed upon the mind of man through centuries of teaching. Darwin wrote first in justification, but then in criticism of his own somewhat shaky faith. Another source of conviction in the existence of God follows from the extreme difficulty, or rather impossibility, of conceiving this immense and wonderful universe, including man with his capacity of looking far backwards and far into futurity, as the result of blind chance or necessity. When thus reflecting, I feel compelled to look to a first cause, having an intelligent mind in some degree analogous to that of man, and I deserve to be called a theist. But then arises the doubt. Can the mind of man, which has, as I fully believe, been developed from a mind as low as that possessed by the lowest animal, be trusted when it draws such grand conclusions? May not these be the result of the connection between cause and effect that strikes us as a necessary one, but probably depends merely on inherited experience? Nor must we overlook the probability of the constant inculcation in a belief in God on the minds of children, producing so strong and perhaps an inherited effect on their brains not yet fully developed, that it would be as difficult for them to throw off their belief in God as for a monkey to throw off its instinctive fear and hatred of a snake. That would seem to fit the case precisely, at least as far as anything but faith can tell us. And faith itself would then, of course, be only a reflex of the imprint to which it referred. To attempt to account then psychologically for those common images, the bricks, that keep turning up alike in all mythologies, let us review briefly some of the inevitable imprints to which the human infant and adolescent, no matter where he may have developed, must always have been subject. These should account for at least a significant part of those sign stimuli by which our human energies are triggered to action and organized for life, as are the instincts of the animals by the various sign systems of their species, those energy-releasing signals by which the organism is struck and moved, as it were, from within. The first of such imprintings are, of course, those to which the infant is subjected in its earliest years. These have been extensively discussed in the literature of psychoanalysis and may be summarized somewhat as follows. 1. Those of the birth trauma and its emotional effects. 2. Those of the mother and father images in their benevolent and malevolent transformations. 3. Those associated with the infant's own excrement and the measures of discipline imposed upon it in relation to this area of experience. 4. Those of the child's sexual researches and findings, whether in the male or in the female mode. And then 5. Those related to his discovery of his place and rating among his peers. There can be little doubt that no matter where in the world an infant may ever have been born, as long as the nuclear unit of human life has been a father, mother, and child, the maturing consciousness has had to come to a knowledge of its world through the medium of this heavily loaded, biologically based triangle of love and aggression, desire and fear, dependency, command, and urge for release. Nor can there ever have been a school for life where the individual did not have to come to terms, one way or another, at a very early age, with his position in the peck series of his intimates. But now, in every primitive society on earth, whether of the hunting or of the planting order, these inevitable imprints and conceptions of infancy are filled with new associations, rearranged and powerfully re-imprinted under the most highly emotional circumstances in the puberty rites, the rites of initiation, to which every young male and often every female too is subjected. That long flume in the Paleolithic grotto of Trois Frères, with the vivid image of the staring sorcerer in the chamber to which it led, may have been employed in such a rite. A fundamental motif in such ceremonials is that of death to infancy and rebirth to adulthood, and this grotto shows every sign of having been used to suggest and effect such a crisis. Moreover, in these rites, the child's body is generally painfully altered through circumcision, subincision, tattooing, scarification, ritual defloration, clitoridectomy, or whatnot, so that there is no childhood to which the child can now return. And through these forceful rearrangements of the references of the father image, mother image, birth idea, etc., the reflex system of the whole psyche is decisively transformed. The infantile system of responses is erased and the energies carried forward away from childhood, away from the attitude of dependency that the long infancy characteristic of our species tends to enforce, on to adulthood, engagement in the local tasks of man and womanhood, to an attitude of adult responsibility and a sense of integration with the local group. A neurotic, then, might be defined as one in whom this initiation has failed of its effect, so that in him those socially organized sign stimuli that carry others on to their adult tasks continue to refer only backward, to the imprint system of the infant. The mother image, then, is experienced only as a reference to the human mother of one's childhood, not to the life-producing, disciplining, and supporting aspect of the world, which is our mother and grandmother, and the father is not Wakantanka, but that undemonstrative relative, as James Joyce terms him, who settles our hash bill for us. All attempts, therefore, to interpret myths through a study of the imagery of neurotics necessarily run the risk of failing to consider precisely that aspect of mythology which is distinctive, namely, its power to carry people away from childhood, from dependency, on to responsibility. Furthermore, the peculiar interests of adulthood differ radically from one society to another, and since it is a primary function of myth and ritual in all traditional societies, not only to shape youngsters into adults, but then also to hold the adults to their given roles, mythology and ritual, insofar as they serve this local, moral, ethical aim, cannot be called functions of any generally valid human psychology, but only of local history and sociology. Professor A.R. Radcliffe Brown of Cambridge University has well discussed this aspect of our subject in his work on the pygmies of the Andaman Islands, where he writes as follows. 1. A society depends for its existence on the presence in the minds of its members of a certain system of sentiments by which the conduct of the individual is regulated in conformity with the needs of the society. 2. Every feature of the social system itself and every event or object that in any way affects the well-being or the cohesion of the society becomes an object of this system of sentiments. 3. In human society, the sentiments in question are not innate, but are developed in the individual by the action of the society upon him. 4. The ceremonial customs of a society are a means by which the sentiments in question are given collective expression on appropriate occasions. 5. The ceremonial, that is, collective expression of any sentiment serves both to maintain it at the requisite degree of intensity in the mind of the individual and to transmit from one generation to another. Without such expression, the sentiments involved could not exist. A mythological system, in short, according to this view, is a natural, spontaneous production of the individual psyche, but a socially controlled reorganization of the imprints of childhood, so contrived that the sign stimuli that move the individual will conduce to the well-being of the local culture, and of that local culture alone. What is effective, as well as distinctive in every mythology, therefore, is its locally ordered architecture, not the bricks, the infantile imprints and their effects, of which this structure is composed. And this architecture, this organization, differs significantly according to place, time, and culture stage. However, there is one more great aspect and function of mythology to be noted, and here we find ourselves moving away again from local back to general terms. For man has not only to be led by myth from the infantile attitude of dependency to an adult assumption of responsibility in terms of the system of sentiments of his tribe, but also in adulthood to be prepared to face the mystery of death, to absorb the mysterium tremendum of being. For man, like no other animal, not only knows that he is killing when he kills, but also knows that he too will die, and the length of his old age, furthermore, is, like his infancy, a lifetime in itself, as long as the entire lifespan of many a beast. Furthermore, even in the period of childhood, and certainly throughout one's adult years, the wonder of death, the awesome, dreadful transformations that immediately follow death, strike the mind with an impact not to be dismissed. The reconciliation of consciousness with the monstrous thing that is life, which lives on death, terminates in death, and begins with the curiously dreamlike event of a birth, is a function served by all primitive and most high culture mythologies that is of no less weight and consequence than the function of imprinting a sociology. Indeed, the local sociology itself rides upon the mystery of life, which, like the mythological sea beneath the earth, is always there. And so, even when serving their social function, mythologies are dealing not only with sentiments not innate to man, developed in the individual by the action of the society upon him, but also with what James Joyce termed in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, the grave and constant in human sufferings. "You have noticed," said the old Sioux medicine man Black Elk to the poet John G. Neihardt, "that the truth comes into this world with two faces. One is sad with suffering, and the other laughs, but it is the same face, laughing or weeping." The Greeks subsumed a like insight in the image of their two contrasting masks, of tragedy and of comedy. "In the Heoka ceremony," Black Elk said, "everything is backwards, and it is planned that people shall be made to feel jolly and happy first, so that it may be easier for the power to come to them. When people are already in despair, maybe the laughing face is better for them, And when they feel too good and are too sure of being safe, maybe the weeping face is better for them to see. And so I think that is what the Heyoka ceremony, the comic mask, is for. Mythology and the rites through which its imagery is rendered open the mind. That is to say, not only to the local social order, but also to the mystery dimension of being, of nature, which is within as well as without, and thereby finally at one with itself. Moreover, the sentiments of this nature within are indeed innate, of love, for example, hate, fear and disdain, wonder, terror and joy. They are not developed in the individual, as the anthropologist states, by the action of the society upon him, but evoked by these means and directed to sociological ends. Nature is prime. It is there at birth. Society is next. It is only a shaper of nature, and a function, moreover, of what it shapes, whereas nature is as deep and finally inscrutable as being itself. Or, as Thomas Mann once phrased this truth, man is not only a social, but also a metaphysical being. In other words, he is not merely a social individual, but also a personality. Consequently, it is wrong to confuse what is above the individual in us with society, to translate it completely into sociology. Doing that, one leaves the metaphysical aspect of the person, what is truly above the individual, out of the account. For it is in the personality, not the mass, that the actual superordinated principle is to be found. The personal factor. And so we find that even in the most emphatically group-oriented traditions, the preservation of the mythological lore is entrusted not to the merely practical men, alert to the needs of the day, but to individuals believed to be uncommonly endowed whose visionary consciousness transcends the claims of the light world. It is hard, said the old Sioux Black Elk to his friend, the poet John G. Neihardt, to follow one great vision in this world of darkness and of many changing shadows. Among these shadows, men get lost. And indeed, even among the very primitive pygmies of the Andaman Islands, to the study of whose extremely simple Stone Age culture the anthropologist Dr. Radcliffe Brown devoted the very volume from which his above-quoted pronouncement concerning social sentiments was taken, it was not the social leaders but the dreamers, Okojumu, the medicine men, who were honored as the authorities on all legendary lore. Moreover, this legendary lore was the base on which the social order itself was founded. All the rites, private and public, all the aims and all the means of life. And these medicine men who spoke from dreams had gained their group-supporting wisdom through experiences of their own, outside the social compound, through personal contact one way or another with the spirits. As classified by Radcliffe Brown, A, through dying and coming back to life again, B, through meeting spirits in the jungle, or C, through extraordinary dreams. Likewise, Black Elk, the Oglala keeper of the sacred pipe, had had a vision of his own, already at the age of 9, and it was to this that he owed those spiritual powers that had qualified him for the priestly office he held. As a boy, he had fallen strangely ill and was lying with his father and mother, sitting by him in the teepee, when through the opening above he saw two men coming down from the clouds, head first, like arrows, each with a spear from the point of which lightning flashed. He had already seen these two 4 years before when he was 5, and they had sung to him then a sacred song. Behold, a sacred voice is calling you. All over the sky, a sacred voice is calling. After which they had wheeled toward where the sun goes down and suddenly were geese. This time, however, they came to the ground, stood a little way off, and said to him, "Hurry, come, your grandfathers are calling you." He felt himself rise to follow them, and it was a truly wonderful great vision that then unfolded. Neihardt has rendered the vision beautifully in the volume Black Elk Speaks, where it opens out page after page, stage beyond stage, for 25 full pages. Confided by the aging seer as a trust in the spring of 1931 to be given to the new world by which his own had been wiped away in the span of his single lifetime, it sings still in those pages with the melody of a distant day that was our own, also in our fathers, the long, brave day of the Paleolithic Great Hunt. The sick child in the teepee spiritually rose following the two spearmen and was carried by a little cloud to a landscape all of cloud where everything was still. And the two men together said to him, "Behold him, the being with the four legs." He looked and saw a bay horse standing. The animal spoke to him, "Behold me, my life history you shall see." Then it wheeled to the west. "Behold them, their history you shall know." And there were 12 black horses yonder, all abreast, with necklaces of bison hooves, their manes lightning and thunder in their nostrils. The bay wheeled to the north. "Behold," and there were 12 white horses, their manes flowing like a blizzard wind, and all about them white geese soaring. Eastward he wheeled, 12 sorrel horses with eyes that glimmered like the daybreak star and manes of morning light. Then south, and yonder stood 12 buckskins, all with horns on their heads and manes that lived and grew like trees and grasses. "Your grandfathers," said the bay, "are having a council. These shall take you, so have courage." All 48 horses then stood in formation behind the bay, who again turned and neighed to the quarters, whereupon the sky of each was terrible with a storm of plunging horses in all colors that shook the world, neighing back. "See," said the bay, "how your horses all come dancing." And there were horses everywhere, a skyful dancing that changed then to all kinds of animals and vanished to the quarters. The pair of spearmen walked with their charge to a cloud that changed to a teepee, and a rainbow was its open door, through which could be seen the 6 grandfathers sitting in a row, like hills, like stars, so old. They were the powers of the west, north, east, south, sky, and earth. And each, to an accompaniment of many marvelous signs, presented tokens to the boy. A bow, the power to destroy, and a cup of water, the power to make live, an herb, the power to make grow, a pipe, the power that is peace, and a bright red stick that was alive, which put forth branches whereon birds sang. "Behold," said the grandfather of the south, "the living center of a nation I shall give you, and with it many you shall save." The spirit of the sky stretched out his arms and turned into a spotted eagle, hovering, while the spirit of the earth, who looked somehow familiar, began very slowly changing, growing backward into youth, and the boy perceived that it was himself, with all the years that would be his. "My boy," he said when he was old again, "have courage, for my power shall be yours, and you shall need it, for your nation on the earth will have great troubles. Come." He rose and tottered through the rainbow door where the boy followed. Again he was riding the bay with the 48 behind him, 4 abreast, all now with riders, and they rode along the black road, eastward. A series of magical adventures followed. Drought overcome by the bow and cup, pestilence cured by the mere passage of this troop, the flowering stick was planted at the center of the nation's hoop, the sacred pipe came flying and a great voice sounded, "Behold the circle of the nation's hoop, for it is holy, being endless, and thus all powers shall be one power and the people without end. Now they shall break camp and go forth upon the red road, and your grandfathers shall walk with them." A beautiful procession formed, the black horse riders with the cup in front, the white with the herb, the sorrel with the pipe, the buckskins with the flowering stick, then all the children, youths, and maidens. Next the tribe's 4 chieftains with young attendants, the 4 advisers with the middle-aged, then the old men and old women, hobbling with canes and looking at the earth, all followed by the boy on his bay with the bow and with the trail of ghosts behind him, of the ancestors like a fog as far as the eye could see. "Behold," said the voice, "a good nation walking in a sacred manner in a good land." But there were 4 ascents ahead, the generations now to come which Black Elk was to know. First, the land all green. Second, green but getting steeper, leaves falling from the tree, and the voice warning, "Remember what your 6 grandfathers gave you, for henceforth your people walk in difficulties. The black road lies ahead." Then third, the people scattering, for each one seemed to have his own little vision that he followed and his own rules. And all over the universe were winds at war. At the summit of this difficult ascent, the nation's hoop was broken, and the next ascent would be horrible. The people were already starving. And now comes that part of the vision which Black Elk in later life took to be the symbol of the spiritual charge placed upon him by the powers for the benefit of his people. But now that I can see it all from a lonely hilltop, he said, as an old man to his friend, I know it was the story of a mighty vision given to a man too weak to use it, of a holy tree that should have flourished in a people's heart with flowers and singing birds, and now is withered, and of a people's dream that died in bloody snow. But if the vision was true and mighty, as I know, it is true and mighty yet, for such things are of the spirit, and it is in the darkness of their eyes that men get lost. What he saw at this point was a man standing on the north side of the starving camp, his whole body painted red, who held a spear as he walked to the center of the people, where he lay down and rolled, and when he got up, was a fat bison. Where he stood, a sacred herb sprang up, where the tree had been in the center of the nation's hoop. This grew and bore four blossoms, a blue, the west, a white, the north, a scarlet, the east, and a yellow, the south. I know now what this meant, old Black Elk told his friend the poet, that the bison were the gift of a good spirit and were our strength, but we should lose them and from the same good spirit must find another strength. A great number of other marvels followed, of which the culmination was the arrival of the boy, still riding his bay horse, on the highest mountain of the world, Harney Peak in the Black Hills. But anywhere, said Black Elk, is the center of the world. And there I was seeing in a sacred manner, he said, the shapes of all things in the spirit, and the shape of all the shapes, as they must live together like one being. And I saw that the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one circle, wide as daylight and as starlight, and in the center grew one mighty flowering tree to shelter all the children of one mother and one father. Presently the two spearmen who had first appeared to the boy returned and became four flocks of geese, one above each quarter of the earth, circling. The cloud teepee again appeared. Underneath were all the animals and men rejoicing. The six grandfathers within welcomed him. He has triumphed, they cried, like thunder, and again each gave the gift he had given before. The teepee rocked and faded. The face of the day of earth was appearing. The sun leaped up and sang as it rose. With visible face I am appearing. In a sacred manner I appear. And when the singing stopped, alone and feeling lost, the boy on the plain saw before him his people's village, his own teepee, and inside his mother and father bending over a sick child that was himself. As he entered, someone said, "The boy is coming too." Then he was sitting up. The elements, the bricks of this marvelous dream, the tree at the world center, the crossing there of the two roads, the world hoop, the world mountain, the guides, the world guardians and their tokens, magical powers, etc., are such as are known to mythologies of many orders. The landscape and the animals involved, on the other hand, the colors and virtues of the four directions, the attitude toward nature and the supernatural, the high roles of the buffalo and the horse, the peace pipe, spotted eagle, etc., are of the architecture of the mythic world of the North American Plains heritage. The intuition that gave rise to this vision in the mental sphere of a 9-year-old boy was personal, however, personal in the sense that no one else had ever had it, though collective indeed, not only in the sense that its imagery was archetypal, but also in that its prophecy was of the destiny not merely of this boy, but of his folk. It was the foresight of an impending crisis, subliminally intuited, together with a statement of the way it was to be met. When he was 17 years old, Black Elk translated a portion of this dream into a rite, a ceremonial for his people that was actually enacted. A man who has a vision, he explained, is not able to use the power of it until after he has performed the vision on earth for the people to see. Thus do mythologies and their rites arise. A ritual is the form through which one participates in a myth, partakes of it, gives oneself to it, and the myth is a group dream projected from the personal collective vision of a seer, a gifted individual. And this condition prevails even in such emphatically anti-individualistic mythological traditions as those of the Old Testament and Quran, where what are put forward as the source inspirations are not group experiences at all, but the voices heard and visions seen by individuals alone. Abraham hearing and heeding the voice of the Lord, Genesis chapter 12. Jacob dreaming his great dream of the heaven ladder, Genesis chapter 28. Moses and the burning bush, Moses on Mount Sinai, Exodus chapter 3 and 19 and following. Muhammad in his meditation cave, Quran, Surah 96. The usual Christian understanding of the good news of Jesus, on the other hand, is that he who brought it, the Lamb of God, was an incarnation of the Holy Power itself, who had come into the world at the close of an old and opening of a new day, rather in the way of the very beautiful holy woman who came, as it were, from nowhere in a strange and wonderful manner with the gift of the sacred pipe. Just when the Oglala Sioux were exchanging one manner of life, that of the forest, for another, that of the plains. The vision of Black Elk was a foreview in the year 1873 of the next exchange before his people, from the hunt to agriculture, the buffalo to the sacred herb. The fair promise of his cult, however, was broken at the root by force majeure in the year of our Lord 1890 at Wounded Knee. "Nothing I have ever seen with my eyes," he said to his friend, at the age of 68, "was so clear and bright as what my vision showed me, and no words that I have ever heard with my ears were like the words I heard. I did not have to remember these things. They have remembered themselves all these years. It was as I grew older that the meaning came clearer and clearer out of the pictures and the words, and even now I know that more was shown to me than I can tell." The Symbol Without Meaning, first presented in Ascona at the Aranos meeting of 1957. Part 1. The Impact of Modern Science. It was Bertrand Russell, as I recall, who once told a New York audience that all Americans believe the world was created in 1492 and redeemed in 1776. The cultural conditioning of an American, then, may account for the history and theory of mythological symbols that I am about to offer in this essay. However, since one of the main themes of my subject is to be that of the provincial character of all that we are prone to regard as universal, we may let the presentation itself stand as an illustration of its own thesis. I cannot forget that for many centuries, the vast majority of the great as well as minor thinkers of Europe believed that the world was created about 4004 BC and redeemed in the first century AD, that Cain, the eldest son of the first human couple, was the first agriculturalist, the first murderer, and the first builder of cities, that the creator of the universe once held in particular regard a certain tribe of Near Eastern nomads for whom he parted the waters of the Red Sea, and to whom he communicated in person his program for the human race, and that, because of the failure of this people to recognize himself when he then became incarnate among them as the son of one of their daughters, the creator of the universe transferred his attention to the northern shores of the Mediterranean, to Italy, Spain, and France, to Switzerland, Germany, and England, to Holland and Scandinavia, and for a while also to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I am quite ready to admit, therefore, that it does seem to me that when the prows of Columbus's three brave little ships, the Santa Maria was a vessel of only 100 tons, the Pinta a caravel of 50, and the Niña a mere 40 tons, when the prows of these three nutshells cut through the world-encircling Ouroboros, ocean, the mythological age of European thought was dealt a lethal blow, and the modern age of global thinking, adventurous experiment, and empirical demonstration inaugurated. Hardly two centuries earlier, St. Thomas Aquinas had sought to show, by reasonable argument, that the Garden of Paradise from which Adam and Eve had been expelled was an actual region of this physical earth still somewhere to be found. The situation of Paradise, he had written, is shut off from the habitable world by mountains or seas or some torrid region which cannot be crossed, and so people who have written about topography make no mention of it. The venerable Bede, 5.5 centuries before, had sensibly suggested that Paradise could not be a corporeal place, but must be entirely spiritual. Augustine, however, had already rejected such a notion, maintaining that Paradise was, and is, both spiritual and corporeal. and it was to Augustine's view that Aquinas brought support. For whatever scripture tells us about paradise, he wrote, is set down as a matter of history, and wherever scripture makes use of this method, we must hold to the historical truth of the narrative as a foundation of whatever spiritual explanation we may offer. Dante, it will be recalled, placed paradise on the summit of the mountain of Purgatory, which his century situated in the middle of an imagined ocean covering the whole of the southern hemisphere, and Columbus shared this mythological image.